history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there, stories that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And it's amazing when we do that, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Bakersfield, California, the 95-year-old veteran of World War II, who's going to tell you a story you've never heard before. And even if we don't make it to World War II in the time we have, the story of his family growing up. Is it true, Marvin Belcher, that you have three sets of twins in your family?
Yes. I'm the eldest of three sets of boys. Twins, yes. One single boy, one single girl. We grew up in near Shawnee, Oklahoma. We were Okies. And we survived the Dust Bowl days and the Great Depression of the 30s there in Oklahoma. We eked out a living on a sharecropper farm owned by a retired school teacher who was blind at the time. And since we were not actually producing much for her share of the income, she came out and lived with us. While you might think that would not be so good, it actually was very good for me, anyway, because as a retired school teacher, even though she was blind, she had great stories and a great sense of humor, and she was good for us, and we enjoyed her. Although my younger brothers had great joy in leading her off the path on her way to the outhouse, you know.
Because she couldn't see where
never,
she was going.
I never would have done that, but my younger brothers had a lot of fun with that.
It's so unique. I'm just thinking about your family growing up. First of all, have you ever encountered anyone else with a family of not one, not two, but three sets of twin boys?
No, I have not. I'm sure there are those situations, but I have not known the people.
And there's
we had a great time, incidentally, growing up. Always a twin. For me, anyway. Well, he was larger. I was older by 28 hours. We celebrate different birthdays.
Which is unique in its own right.
Yeah. They walked me home from Johnson School. We were always living, even though at different places, always an hour and a half away from school and church, because church was right catacorner across from the school. Well, at one time, one of these Davenport boys, a little bit older than my brother and me, had my brother down on the ground punching him in the face, you see. And so I came along and pulled him off, and he got up and says, "I'm going to knock your head off." And he delivered one. I thought he had made good on his promise. But in 1941, my dad decided, after hearing from friends who had gone to California, it seemed to be some improvement. So he decided, well, if I don't get more pay for helping bale hay down in the bottom lands of the Canadian River, we're going to go to California. Well, there was no increase in pay, so we loaded up eight kids and the parents, 10 people in a 36 Chevrolet pickup, and headed for California.
10 people in a 36 Chevrolet pickup. So yeah. You were riding in the truck bed?
Yes, we had kind of a, like the old pictures of the wagons, covered wagons, you know, the back of the pickup was like that, with the mattresses on the bottom. Underneath that are canned goods, what we could take along. And we had very little money to start out, but made it to my mother's uncle in Empire, California. And that was our home until we got established. My dad had charge of a peach orchard there just out of Empire. So we had a job from the beginning because of my uncle, my great uncle. So we had a very good plus at that point. We were peach pickers, and that was between my sophomore year and junior year in high school. We came to California in June of 41. The bombs were dropped on Pearl Harbor in December of 41. So immediately we were looking at war. And of course, as a junior in high school, I knew that I better get in the best situation I could get into. So I looked forward to becoming a pilot. With my intensity of effort and desire, I could not pass the exam, physical exam, to become a pilot. I had high blood pressure. I was pumped. Well, first of all, it was V-12 program. That's when I messed up. My twin brother made the V-12 program, Navy training program.
Right, where you'd go to a college campus.
Yes.
And study.
He ended up going to Schenectady after Cal Berkeley and was a high-ranking executive, a salesperson with General Electric. Finally decided that sales was not his forte, so he did a little side teaching at Cal Poly Pomona. Decided he liked that so well, he would make that his career, which he did. Anyway, getting back to my story, I could not pass a physical exam. For Army Air Corps, they said my overbite was too much. The Navy Air Corps said my nose was not quite straight enough. Well, finally, the draft came along, and they couldn't find anything wrong with me. So I was drafted, and again, I applied to become a pilot. Passed all the tests, was out here at Mentor Field in Bakersfield, outside of Bakersfield, waiting for the college phase of the training. When they decided they needed more gunners rather than pilots, so since I was drafted, they were free to change my classification. And I went for flexible gunnery school, Kingman, Arizona, became a ball turret gunner. Had a wonderful crew to work with, flew our plane from Avon Park, Florida to England. We had 26 missions as a crew.
Let me ask you, there are a couple things there that I'm just curious about, and maybe I'll go in chronological order. I don't want to slow you down too much. But you mentioned early on the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression, and I'm just imagining when there's 8 kids in the family and, people are having a hard enough time taking care of one person, let alone a family of 10. Did you feel the effects of that, or are there some things that you saw then that have given you perspective on the rest of your life?
I'm sure there were things that gave me perspective. We never lacked for food. We had chickens, eggs. Had Sunday dinners were always chicken dinners. We had a great garden. We raised our own pigs for meat. And we had cows for milk and beef as well. And while we worked hard, occasionally we'd be able to work for a neighbor if they needed extra help. 10 hours a day for $1 a day. I was just a junior in high school at that time, but I remember those days, 10 hours a day for $1 a day. But we had a lot of fun, too, with the brothers that
sure.
I had. Interestingly, one of my favorite friends there, Robert Harp, was killed in the Army. The neighbor across the fence, Russell Paris, was killed in the Army. His best friend, the next road over, was killed. My favorite cousin, who lived with us, or with whom we lived, rather, at Empire. When he graduated from high school, he joined the Marine Corps, didn't come back.
Wow.
So there was a lot of people who did not come back from the war. I was most fortunate and took advantage of the GI Bill afterwards. If you want to go on to that segment.
Well, yeah, just a couple more questions I have as I try to understand the shoes you've walked in. When you were that kid, the oldest of the 8 kids in Oklahoma, do you remember having an ambition or a dream of, hey, someday this is what I want to do with my life? This is
yeah.
who I'm going to be?
Yes. Miss Emma, the retired line school teacher, and telling her stories, was telling about a relative of hers that was a cook for a restaurant. And so there were a lot of things that I looked forward to that would be better than working on the farm. So my first desire was to become a cook. Well, I never became a cook. In high school, after I got to Modesto, I decided a commercial major would be good. I'd be better pushing a pencil rather than handling the hoe. So shorthand, stenography, and all of it goes with that, office practice. I was always a good student. I graduated from 8th grade with straight A's. After they found out at Modesto that even though I was in Oki, they put me in the lower classes, and I soon was able to move to college prep, which was quite a bump for me. So when I came back from the war, I attended Modesto Junior College 1 year and then thought I would become a minister. And our church, Church of the Brethren, had a college down in South, Laverne College at the time. And I decided, that's a good move for me. While there, I took advantage of the GI Bill. Of course, it didn't cost me any additional money. Free college for about 6 years, actually more than 6 years. And so I graduated from college with honors, took graduate work at Claremont Graduate School, and then on to USC. So when I came to Bakersfield, I was ahead of the class, mostly of the incoming teachers. So after 2 years of teaching sixth grade, then the next year I was with the seventh grade. The following year I had passed the test to become a counselor and also the test to score high for principalship. So in my fourth year I became a principal. That followed with 23 years in the principalship.
So you were a pretty young principal, weren't you?
Yes, I was. And I was a popular principal. I enjoyed it, and I was fortunate to be in a school where had a great staff of teachers and good students, and they all seemed to have an idea that they were there to learn. So I had a good experience with elementary K-6 school. And then I was transferred to 7th and 8th grade school for the years 1960 to 1973. That was during the racial revolution, so to speak, of the 60s in Bakersfield. And while it was a challenging thing, it turned out that it was difficult to do anything right. Someone had an objection to the decision you were making. I had, at that time, threats on my life. Decided, well, this 7th and 8th grade level is not really to my liking. So I asked to go back to lower grades to Colonel Baker School. Again, a great experience. And having done other additional work at USC, did everything except write the dissertation for the doctorate. But at that time, the popular thing in school district administration was preparing for what eventually was to be working with the unions, writing contracts and so forth. So I became a negotiator. I had more practice and more experience and more training to be a negotiator than anyone else in the district. And so while I didn't know whether I had the stomach for it, it turned out that I was able to kind of set myself above the fray, do a reasonable good job as a negotiator, and things went well for 9 years before I retired in 1985.
I'm bouncing around a little bit here. Just other things keep coming to mind. So you mentioned that you got to Modesto in June of 41. 6 months later, Pearl Harbor happens. But it seems like everyone has a memory of that. So what's yours? December 7th, 1941, where were you and how'd you find out?
Well, I was a junior in high school at that time. We had the radio. We listened intently to what was going on in Pearl Harbor. And we were in the war right away. So as a junior in high school, I figured it's just a matter of time. We're not going to get this thing settled probably before I'm out of high school. I better be thinking in terms of what I might do. I did not want to be a foot soldier. I wanted to be a pilot. So I was fortunate in a very real way to become a ball turret gunner on a B-17. I didn't have to carry the pack in Europe, you see, or in the South Pacific.
Well, some may disagree with whether or not that's fortunate to be in the ball turret, but we'll talk more about that. As far as wanting to be a pilot, was there something that had triggered that earlier, where you were exposed to aviation?
Or yes.
What was that?
From where we lived in Oklahoma, here was the Valley View Elementary School, a mile and a half away. Just before you get to the school, off to the left was a big pasture. When we were walking to that school, maybe fifth grade, sixth grade, there was a plane that landed on that pasture because of some necessity. I'm not just sure what, but that plane was there for several days, and I was able to get up close. I was fascinated by the airplane, and that was when my interest first started to wanting to be a pilot. Things developed from there. I wasn't a pilot, but
right. And since you're one of seven boys in the family, I'm curious how many of those seven ended up in the armed forces at some point.
My twin brother was a naval person. He ended up in some aspect of radio on the ship by the name of Oklahoma City, which I thought was kind of unique, mm-hmm. since we had left Oklahoma City a few miles from Oklahoma City.
So that would have been a cruiser then, if it's
a city.
Yeah,
a cruiser. Uh-huh. Yeah. Next eldest brother, Roy, was also joined the Navy. And the other boys, 5 years younger than we, the oldest twins, were two young for World War II, but we were at Empire Church, Church of the Brethren, and there was a pretty strong viewpoint of war is wrong, conscientious objection to war, which I also believed, but I joined anyway. Well, anyway, they both took positions of opposition to war. One took his alternate service in Puerto Rico, some kind of a service project, and the other was in the Army, but he was in the entertainment business and playing football. The middle set of twins were outstanding football players at Laverne,
eventually.
But he was a football player in the Army and was in this special unit of having fun rather than... This was after the war, of course.
Sure.
My dad was in the Army in the World War I, but he never got to fight. He was on this troop ship during the time of a lot of flu. You know, you remember the flu?
Spanish flu, yeah.
And so he kind of lasted out the war, World War I, on this troop ship ready to sail, but never made it because they were dealing with the flu.
Okay.
It's kind of a strange situation. But Dad was always a very real supporter for me. And especially, I remember the last thing he said to me as I boarded the bus there in Modesto. He says, "Marvin, let me tell you something. Be the best soldier in the Army." Mm. So that was a moving thing for me. It still is, even to remember it.
I can hear it.
But...
That's the kind of standard he expected you to uphold.
Yeah.
You know, another thing I wondered there is you were talking about finding out on December 7th that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. I'm guessing that back in Oklahoma you hadn't had any Japanese-American classmates, but perhaps in Modesto you did?
In fact, that was true. Not in Oklahoma, but in Modesto. In fact, a bright Japanese boy rode the bus with us from Empire to Modesto to high school. Very fine boy. They had a Japanese garden and sold the product, you know, around. And very fine people sent off to concentration camps. Very unfair, as we see it this day. But at that time, they were considered a risk. And so the sentiment seemed to be, we got to reduce the risk, potential risk.
Yeah, the only reason I brought it up is I'm wondering how that strikes a, what were you, 17-year-old kid, I guess? You know, when this guy you've been riding the bus with all of a sudden is packed up with his family and taken off his land and sent away.
Yeah, well, those things didn't seem fair, but they were beyond my control. So there was enough that was within my control to concern me, and that was where the focus was.
And we're going to hear more about that when we come back. 95-year-old Marvin Belcher of Bakersfield, California is our guest today. You'll find photos of him then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we're going to hear about his Army Air Corps journey when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 95-year-old Marvin Belcher of Bakersfield, California, a man of many talents. college football player, middle school principal, still a Sunday school teacher at the Church of the Brethren in Bakersfield, and a champion camellia grower. In fact, it was another member of the Camellia Society of Kern County, Rosemary McGuire, who let me know about Marvin's story. So thank you, Rosemary. And after seeing the decades-old camellias growing in his backyard, I don't think Mr. Belcher's championship days are over yet. We heard about how he grew up with his twin brother Mel and two other sets of twin boys among the eight Belcher kids in Shawnee, Oklahoma, moving to Empire, California, outside of Modesto in high school. And after enlisting in the Army Air Corps in 1943, he had basic training in Denver, Colorado, before ending up at Minter Field in Shafter, California, just northwest of Bakersfield.
Well, here I had my appendix out, so I lost contact with the group I was with in basic. But in the recovery program, I enjoyed this swimming pool built primarily by the Rotary Club of Bakersfield there at Minter Field. So I spent many days at the pool because I had to be completely recovered before I went on to my flexible gunnery training.
Well, and I'm curious because now, you know, if people drive through Shafter, California today, there's a little air museum at Minter Field, but so much of what was there in the 40s is gone. That was a pretty hopping, happening place, wasn't it?
Yeah, it sure was. It was a big place.
With a whole bunch of BT-13s, right? Those infamously vibrating, Volte-Valiant trainers that so many pilots would endure on the way to earning their wings?
It was not the primary training that they had. It was the basic training. A very elementary airplane, but one capable of a lot of learning. But we were on the line, and we cleaned up the planes and so forth, but we were in a waiting mode. It heightened our expectation, though, our desire, the excitement. We had a lot of excitement later on, but it was not as a pilot. So.
Well, and when they told you that, when they said, hey, we've got enough pilots, but we need some guys to squeeze themselves into that little ball turret on the bottom of a B-17 and risk their lives, was that a disappointment to you that you didn't get to be a pilot?
Yes, it was, but I was glad to be in the air anyway.
And you said flexible gunnery school out in Arizona. What do they do, though?
You learn to use the ball turret.
And most of us have never or will never be in that position. Some of us couldn't even fit, and I'll raise my hand on that one. So how do you do that? What do you have to master or learn or get used to?
Well, you go in from the fuselage of the plane, and it's just back of the radio place. Of course, at the end of the tail, we had a tail gunner there. And in between the tail and the ball turret, there were waist gunners.
Right, one on either side.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so we went in through a hatch. We cranked the guns down, 90 degrees down, that we could open the hatch then and crawl in. I was only 139 pounds then, so I could go in okay. And then when you get in, sit down, close the hatch, bring the guns up. Well, we didn't do that in combat until we got to about the English Channel. At that time, we crawled in, and from that time on until we got back to the English Channel, I was in the ball. Mm-hmm. I could control those guns, 50 calibers, one on each side of the knee, from straight back all the way around 360 degrees and 90 degrees down, straight down. So all of that space I was able to survey and keep track of and shoot down any fighter planes that were in our way.
Does that get claustrophobic at all?
Fortunately, not much at all. I looked at it this way. I've got more protection from the flak with these 50 calibers on my with my legs and with other metal around me. That was probably better off than the waist gunner or the tail gunner for sure. And so I felt, well, if I can only get out fast when I need to, this is probably the best place. And I liked the sight from there. You know, I could see a lot of what was going on, see what was happening after we dropped the bombs and the fires and cinderies, and had a great view. But I knew that after we dropped the bombs, there was a lot of death and destruction. So that bothered me, but that was part of the job.
I'm wondering, in training, what did they tell you? Did they give you an expectation of what it was going to be like? Or I've had some guys who were gunners in the Army Air Corps say, hey, they told us the average life expectancy was X number of minutes in combat. Did they have any caution like that for you?
No.
How about, did you hear stories of what could or had happened to other ball turret gunners.
Yeah, stories that happen with the entire crew. If the anti-aircraft fire burst in the right place, the whole plane engulfed in flames, and you hoped that you could bail out and the parachute worked and you could sail down to safety, most likely captured and going to a camp from the Germans. There was no dread of being in the ball turret.
I've heard a few stories of ball turret gunners who got trapped in there because the gears were shot up.
There's a great movie on that. Yeah.
I've talked to pilots who had to try to land that way without killing the guy in the ball turret. Did you think about those eventualities?
I did. In fact, at 139 pounds, I was able to hook my little parachute on at my side, one hook here, with the expectation that if all else failed, I could maybe open the hatch and push myself out. I got my parachute on. If I can't hook the other side, if not, I'll go down with one hook. That would be better than not being able to get out if need be. So I planned for those days. Most of the ball turret gunners probably could not have put their parachute down beside them. And thankfully, I never had to check it out to see if it would work.
So they take you from Arizona to Florida. Were you there long before you hopped across the pond?
Not too long. We met our crew there and were trained as a crew.
What was that like?
Well, it was getting to meet a great bunch of guys, a pilot that I really came to like a great deal. We probably were the most alike, Walter and pilot. And older, he was 26 years old, he's the navigator, so he was kind of pops, you know.
Yeah.
The waist gunner was a guy that I kept in contact with longer than any other member of the crew. We never, after the war, could locate what happened to our bombardier.
Hmm.
Otherwise, we were out in 1945, and I didn't learn until about 72 or something like that, that the group was having reunions. And so I picked that up, and my wife and I attended with other crew members and their wives the reunions, which were very, very nice. And so every other year, from 72 to about 90. And by then, well, our biggest reunion was the last reunion that we had as a group, as a crew. And we had at that point, was it five or six members of the 9-member crew were present.
Wow.
That was great fellowship and remembrance.
How many of those 9 guys are living today?
I don't know if any of them are. I know that there's a possibility that the waist gunner may still be living, but I have not been in contact with him for 20 years probably.
So it sounds like you guys hit it off pretty well.
We did.
And probably you needed to, because you were going to be relying on each other to survive, huh?
Exactly. You know, it's kind of interesting. We all have personalities. I was the one who later decided to become a minister, changed my mind before I got there, but I was a church person. My mother walked us to church 2 times on each Sunday, so I was very much pushed to accept Christ, to become a Christian and live according to his plan for my life. Anyway, but there was from that kind of a background to, I don't know, maybe no background. I don't know what the background was, but we had tail gunner who could open, when we were on our leave, he could open the cork of the bottle and he became intoxicated immediately and enjoyed that freedom. And so there was that element of how do you behave when you're on leave? There was a lot of good entertainment. We enjoyed the leaves, made it to London a couple of times, but Northampton was where the bus usually took us for the big chindigs. And the ladies from England could really dance. We had the jitterbug, I think that's what they called it. I was never a dancer. I was usually along the wall somewhere. I tried, but I just never felt comfortable on the dance floor. But anyway, those are memories.
Being there stationed in England, and especially going into London, did you get a taste for what the British people had been through in this war and what they'd suffered?
Yes.
What are some of the things that brought that home for you?
Well, for one thing, the open arms they gave us, they appreciated so much our being there, and they could not express enough their appreciation. It was a very positive relationship with GIs and the people living there in England. I was able to visit St. Paul's and some of the palaces of the royalty. So the experience expanded my knowledge of at least that part of the world. I had great appreciation for the way they treated us. Anyway, it was a learning experience for sure.
Well, I'm sure your first mission was quite the learning experience. Do you remember what was going through your mind before you took off? Think you were scared or anxious or anything?
Well, anxious perhaps. But we were well trained. We knew what we were supposed to do. And we were waiting for those planes to come in. My function was to knock out any fighter planes that I had a chance to knock out. Fortunately, in 26 missions, I only saw one fighter plane, German. And it came in from up above, down through mixed clouds. I don't know if he even knew we were there. And by the time I could get my sights on him, he was off beyond distance. So we never had that to contend with. But the flak was always there. And I remember even on the first mission, it was not too heavy. And so I kind of thought, well, this is possible. So I was encouraged there. But we had some missions, like when we were in, we bombed Berlin twice and other key missions more than once. And always they filled the sky with bursting anti-aircraft fire.
And all that separates you from that flak is the bottom of that turret, right?
I would say I was aware of the folks back home praying. I knew that my church was praying for me, Empire. Wonderful people there. Even though there's a church, the official position was to be anti-participating.
Pacifist.
Yeah. Pacifist, yes. Their prayers were intense in our behalf. So there was not much underneath that turret to protect me. But I have the feeling that while I can't put it into words because I don't know exactly and precisely, but that God had his hand in it. And I appreciated that. I did a lot of praying during the mission.
Sure.
Too. So.
Well, I want to make sure I understand you correctly. I know that your perspective now is certainly that God protected you through all this. But it sounds like you're saying, even as that young man in that ball turret for those 26 missions, you had some kind of peace or comfort or even palpable feeling that there was protection around you?
Yes. At least it appeared to be that way because I was, and in fact, our entire crew came back unscratched.
And it wasn't for lack of flak.
That's for sure.
And I'm guessing the flak did some damage to some of those B-17s you were in.
Oh, yes. It's amazing what change the ground crew can make from the time you get back. Maybe, depending on when you leave. We always left before daybreak. Maybe we'd get, our longest mission was, I think, 11 hours. And that was without refueling along the way. So there was always that question, are we going to make it? Do we have enough fuel? And there were a lot of planes that did not have enough fuel. Mm-hmm. They exceeded their limit. And the crew, the ground crew did a magnificent job of repair of planes and having them ready to go the next morning. I couldn't believe this plane was badly hit. It was ready to go the next morning.
Were there ever occasions where you had the chance to look at some of those shrapnel holes, the damage that is done to the plane,
See
how close it was to you?
Yeah. I don't believe that the ball, to my memory, was ever damaged, but there were holes in the fuselage and along the wings and so forth. 100 holes in one, and from a few to 100.
So one mission, as many as 100 holes in that plane.
Yeah.
But no one's hurt.
Right.
Sounds like there's some merit to your theory that somebody was looking out for you there.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were also occasions, since you're flying in formation, even if you didn't encounter a lot of enemy fighters, you probably saw things happen to some of those other planes in your formation, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, this one that stands out, you know, in formation, is the lead plane off to the right, plane on the left, and the trailing plane. I remember this one mission where the plane that was just off our wingtip over here on the left, and I never did learn what happened to them, but he dropped out, went down, not in a spiral or anything, but just had to drop out of the formation, and I could see he was way off. He was not able to stay up. So I didn't see any bursting planes, but with a lot of holes, you know, that B-17 was quite an airplane. It could come back badly damaged. And I was glad for the B-17 rather than the B-24 Liberator. There were those who liked the Liberator, but for my money, it's the B-17.
Well, if it brought you home 26 times, I guess the proof's in the pudding.
Yeah.
And we'll explore some of those 26 missions when we come back, plus how he met his wife of 72 years, Virginia, and why his experience with Honor Flight Kern County was so meaningful to him. 95-year-old Marvin Belcher of Bakersfield, California is our guest today, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Wherever you're listening this week, I'm sure there's something about Marvin Belcher's story that has made an impression on you. If you're listening on our longtime affiliate, KNZR, in Bakersfield, California, you might be saying to yourself, I remember that voice. Marvin Belcher was my principal. He spent 23 years as an elementary and middle school principal in Bakersfield. But he spent the final months of World War II in Europe climbing in and out of the ball turrets of B-17s, 26 missions worth, before the war came to an end. Were those missions pretty much the same for you time after time, or was there always something new or different?
We went to the same mission. I mean, we went two times to several different missions. But for the most part, it was a difference in altitude, difference in what we were to look at and hit, and then to see from my position what kind of smoke, what kind of damage appeared to be done. Although at 5 miles up, you don't have a real good indication of how much damage was done. We could tell by the smoke and the color of the smoke that there was a lot of damage. And I'm sure that there were a lot of people killed along the way as well.
You know, you mentioned 5 miles up, and one thing I don't think a lot of people understand today is that you're flying that kind of extreme altitude, but these are not pressurized airplanes.
Not pressurized airplanes, but we did wear oxygen masks.
Yeah.
We had a heated...
An electric heated suit?
Yeah. Never failed.
Good. One more thought about some of these bomb runs, because you can see just about everything from where you are, right? Except what's above you, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
When you know that there's flak out in front, and your plane in this formation is still going straight at the target, and you're going to be flying through a field of flak, how do you prepare for that? What do you do?
Say a prayer. But it is true. You see the bursting rounds. Now, it's happening all around, but you see something is coming right at you. And every time one breaks, it's closer. And the first thing you know, you think, hey, are we bouncing around when we're ahead here? Because it must be right on us. And at that time, you begin to really pray. I did anyway. And hope that nothing critical happens. And fortunately, we never had a critical incident. You know, even though they had advanced anti-aircraft fire at the end of the war when we were there, the last from February to May of 45, before VE Day, the anti-aircraft fire from the German side, you know, was very much improved and accurate, but it just never was accurate enough. It was largely put it up there and see what happens and then tracking. But from my viewpoint, that stuff was going off all around us. But we had a lot of planes in the air, too. They were not aiming specifically for our plane. But it seemed like some of that stuff coming in was right on our... We were right in the hairlines.
Well, I guess, too, and you said something there that, you know, it feels like it's right on you. If you're in that ball turret and you're watching it, and then some of that flak actually hits your aircraft, what does that feel like? What do you feel?
For the most part, you don't know it till you get back.
Uh-huh.
Or if the damage, you know, is so great that you obviously can see it. Mm-hmm. If you lose part of your wing or tail or wherever. But we never had that kind of... We had holes, but we didn't have critical damage. I came back from my week away. One mission, way over there. We got back. We didn't have a call for a mission for about 3 days. Then we learned VE Day. The war is over in Europe. So that's why we had only one after the rest and recuperation.
What was that like to get that news? How did people react where you were?
A lot of joy and delight, but you never know what's next. We actually were converted to troop ships, and I was lady who comes by and offers you some food, you know.
Flight
steward.
Attendant?
I was a flight attendant for GIs. At that time, we had gone down to Istres, France, where they had this concentration of German men, but we also were bringing our boys home, and so we would fly them from Istres, France, which is the southern part of France, over to Casablanca. And near Casablanca, they boarded a troop ship and were sailed home. So I was the guy who tried to make everyone comfortable.
And this is on a B-17 or like a C-47?
B-17.
B-17 becomes a passenger plane.
Yeah.
And were these guys who had been prisoners? Or
no.
Just regular GIs?
Yeah, regular GIs. There was a prisoner camp, however, of Germans there at this part of France.
Was that a different experience to be flying when nobody was shooting at you?
Yes. Yes, it was. And the GIs, they were not very demanding either. There's not much I could do, in fact. And I finally decided, since they gave us an option to do this, that I would request transfer to the Pacific Theater, because we were still fighting the Japanese at that point. And they granted my request, and I was shipped home for a furlough. And while I was home at Empire, VJ, Victory in Japan, was signed. And so instead of going to that theater, I was sent to Santa Ana, where I became a typist awaiting for discharge with air medals and other points I had picked up along the way. I was loaded with stuff that counted toward early dismissal. And so I was out on November 1st of 45.
And you put the GI Bill to work, and you went to Laverne, now the University of Laverne. I guess it's a good thing you went there, too, because I think that had a pretty big role in your life, didn't it?
Tremendous. It was a tremendous experience, not only academically, but socially and sports. I was able to play football with the greatest coach of all time in my mind. I was a running back at 155 pounds.
What was the coach's name?
Ortmeyer. Ort. He was three letters, different sports, at Northwestern University.
Uh-huh.
Great participant, great athlete, but a great sense of he's there to help you. And he and his wife took care of the students in one of the dorms. We lived off campus always. But he and his wife were both, that was typically the experience at Laverne. Professors, coaches, the theologians, and everything. It was an outstanding experience. And let me just say that it's been my privilege to serve on the Board of Trustees representing our church, Church of the Brethren, since 1967 until I'm still, what do they call it?
Emeritus?
Yeah.
For the University of Laverne Board?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah.
Who was your guy's big football rival? Would that have been like Occidental or...
We played Occidental, but not so much. It would be more like Whittier, Pomona College, always uh-huh. tough. And it was just that few miles away, you know. But we had others that were not quite so tough. You know, and the team was mostly guys like myself. We were not professional football players or either players with the experience. But we came together as a team with great coaching and good sense of togetherness and had a lot of fun. And we won a few games. But winning was not the big thing. It was nice to win, but it was just the experience. And that was kind of the experience at Laverne. Virginia.
I was going to say, I think you met someone pretty special there, too.
One time we were sitting on the steps of Miller Hall waiting for dinner to be served down in the basement. And one of these guys, Tiny Christman from San Diego, to us guys, there goes the girl with the most beautiful hair of any girl on campus. I began to take note of her for this, you know. And sure enough, there was a lot of agreement there.
Did he say hair or did he say legs?
Hair. He said hair. She had good legs, too. She was an athlete, and we began dating, and I would pump her on my bicycle to the dance over in San Dimas, and we had a great time together. So it was Laverne, and then Claremont Graduate School, came to Bakersfield. But it was a good move. And, you know, from traveling from Modesto to Laverne several times during my student days, I knew that Bakersfield was hot at times. And I knew that that's not someplace I wanted to live forever. So I said, well, I'll go there for a couple of years, and then that's all I'm going to commit to. But Bakersfield was a nice place. They treated us well, the school district, the church, our friends, and the weather wasn't all that bad. So we've been here ever since.
What year was that you came?
That was 1950.
So 2 years turned into 70, and you two have been married 72 years.
Yeah.
What's your secret to that? What advice do you have for men who want to stay married that long?
She's always right. And that's not just a loose statement. I was fortunate in getting one of those girls that was committed to the person she was marrying, and I was committed to her. And not that we've had some disagreements. She's a vegetarian. My days throughout my life, I'm a meat eater, enjoy it. But we decided that she would eat some meat and I would eat a lot of vegetables. And it turned out that basically worked out, although she was a great violinist. She played 40 years in the Baseball Symphony Orchestra.
Oh, wow.
And she finally decided that her fingers were not performing well. She thought it was maybe the meat. So she said, I'd like to go back to vegetarianism. So I appreciate the fact that she was a violinist, and if that was what she needed to do, I could still manage.
Yeah, you were talking earlier about guys that you knew, whether it's back home in Oklahoma or Empire, who didn't come home from the war. I'm guessing you've been on one of the honor flights since Kern County has such a great honor flight program.
I was talked into it because I thought, I don't need this. But I was talked into it. Phil Niederauer, he said, you ought to go. And I finally said, after a lot of nagging, okay, I'll go if you'll be my guardian. Helkes, that's a deal. And so I could not believe the emotional impact that had. I was so tied up, I could hardly talk almost all the time there. They tried to make us feel like heroes, you know. We were not heroes. We did what we had to do, what everyone else was doing. Nothing new about or heroic about what I was doing about in terms of what everyone else was doing. So Phil Niederauer was a special person in my life to have encouraged me to do that. He's still special to me. But I am a fan of what is being done in the Honor Flight. I'm a supporter of Honor Flight because I know what it did for me.
When they made you feel like that on that Honor Flight, and you were at that World War II memorial where they've got all those gold stars.
Yeah.
And you know that's representing 406,000 guys like you who didn't come home.
That's for sure.
What did you think about there?
It made me grateful that I was not one. I'm not represented on that wall. I'm able to go there and give thanks to Almighty God for the appreciation, and for His protection, and His involvement in our, not only in our world, but in the United States. You know, we are a divided country right now like I've never seen it before. And I think that is so bad. It is so bad. It's not just a little bit. It's big. And we don't know what the future holds. It doesn't look good right now. But Honor Flight, I think, plays a good role, not only in honoring those who were able to come back, but in terms of calling attention to what are the qualities that make America great. And you need to be careful there because you don't know what you might be called to do in making America great or making our country great or our family great or whatever, what God has yet ahead for us. You know, they say the best is yet to come. It's going to be pretty good if it's best is yet still ahead because I've had a great life.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing a story with us that only you could. Is there anything else that I didn't ask you about that you think it's important for people to know? Maybe is there a lesson of World War II or the way the country was then that we can draw from today?
It is so different now than it was then. We were basically, my background was basically rural, and that's true for most people my age. It's a different world we live in, but we have to adapt. We don't want to become worldly. We want to be faithful to God's purpose for each one of us. And I think there is that to consider, and we need to take it very seriously, to do the right thing, whatever that is, in family, church, community, nation, whatever it is, there's still a good reason to be alive and to give it the old college try with God's help.
Well, I'll just ask you one more because I'm thinking about what you said about Honor Flight. You said you know what it did for you. So I'm just wondering if you can flesh that out for me a little bit. How did it make you feel? Because it sounds like you were reluctant to go, but maybe you felt thankful that you did.
Yes, I didn't feel like I needed it. I was very busy. I didn't need another thing. But I think the thing that impressed me was what it did to me, which was almost uncontrollable. How I could not control my emotions. I couldn't speak.
And you're not used to that.
I like to talk, and if I can't talk, I don't like that. But I think that there was something good about that. We're not perfect by a long shot.
Because the Church of the Brethren is of a pacifist persuasion, there was almost a sense of awkwardness that you had fought
yes.
in a war.
Yes.
But this gave you some catharsis or
yes,
acceptance?
I think that's not necessarily in the church, although in the church I have been appreciated for my work in the church and my faith and my sticking to my faith, even though I didn't do so in the war. There is that sense, I don't know, I don't feel now that the church holds that against me because I had a sense of relief, I think, that I had not expected, and even to this day I can't explain all the psychology of it and how it came about. But I went in as a high schooler, just out of high school, and life has been good to me. I've had a chance to be of service. My life has been worthwhile to those around me. I say that not in an egotistical way, but if what I believe is to be the truth. And there's a spiritual reality to that that I don't want to undercut. It's been a good life, and I have felt all along the way the presence of the Holy Spirit, my commitment to Jesus as my Savior, my commitment to my community, my family. It's just been terrific. All of this has fit together with a lot of good memories, not only of friends long departed, but friends to this day. However, at 95, you kind of outlive a lot of your friends, and I'm grateful to still be alive. I think in some respects, a lot of respects, I'm getting near the end of the rope. But God is good, and if he has work for me to do, so be it. I have a sense of some things where my work is not finished yet.
Marvin Belcher, 95 years young and still looking forward. Don't forget to check out the photos of Mr. Belcher at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.